They've gone on about these 15-minute cities, which they claim are attempts by local authorities to tax you or stop you from going beyond kind of 15 minutes of your house or whatever. Welcome to Calling All Stations, the transport podcast. I'm Christian Womar, an author and journalist who has covered transport for the past 30 years. In every episode, we try to keep you up to date with the most engaging news stories, policy developments, and interviews in the transport world. And with me is my regular co-presenter, Mark Walker, who has spent decades looking at transport policies and legislation. So, Mark, what have we got on the agenda today?
Hello, Christian, and hello to our listeners. We have the third of our visits to the HS2 construction sites. This time we've been in Birmingham and we'll be reporting from the Curzon Street station site and the approach to it. We'll also be delving into the culture wars around the use of road space, which is an issue that that keeps on coming back and has renewed energy again in recent days. Christian, you and I were the guests of HS2 Limited and the consortia building the HS2 infrastructure in Birmingham last week. And what a fascinating trip it was.
Absolutely, Mark. I mean, as you know, I've not been a great fan of HS2, but it was impossible not to see the enthusiasm for what they were doing there, which was very impressive. And of course, while I wasn't a supporter of HS2, the idea of kind of cutting it off at Handsacre Junction and not doing anything north of Birmingham effectively, announced by the Prime Minister at the Tory Party conference in a kind of completely haphazard way, is an absolute disgrace. And that the kind of work that's going into Curzon Street and the effort that's going in just shows that there is a lot of kind of potential for this, even though, you know, it is costing a lot of money and is, you know, in terms of transport, not the best scheme in the world. But we might as well make use of what they've done and what they're doing. And, you know, Curzon Street, what I learned was it's much more than just a station. You know, the contract involves actually around 90 kilometres around the station, the various entries from the south and then eventually back up to Handsacre Junction, the interchange station, which apparently is going to be fairly modest, the interchange station near Birmingham Airport. But then there's Curzon Street itself, the station.
Which is going to be magnificent, isn't it, from what we learned.
Which, look, I mean, they haven't really started work on it, but there's plenty of space there. The site is absolutely cleared, and it does look like it's going to be amazing. But then what I hadn't realised, Mark, was that there's this huge viaduct. The railway comes in at the viaduct level, not on the surface. And so therefore there's a bit longer than a mile long viaduct that will bring the railway over various different, the canal, different transport aspects, the canal, the road, the mainline railway and so on.
And they have much of the city centre actually as well, wasn't it?
Much of the city centre. They have to find ways of getting over that. And that was most impressive, wasn't it? The bridges and the way they're building these bridges.
Well, they're things of beauty, aren't they, in many ways? I mean, remarkable achievements in design, engineering, construction, arcing across central Birmingham into the Curzon Street station. And we got close up and personal with the actual sort of foundations of those, of the viaduct, the supports for the viaduct, but also some of the bridges that will form part of the continuous viaduct structure.
Yeah, I was most impressed with that, because they've got a bridge that is built that I think it weighs 1600 tons or something, and it's sitting on some sort of temporary rests at the moment. And they're going to have to slide that across a main road over the space of 9 nights. And they're going to have to turn it round 90 degrees because
first
it's
of
at
all,
the
that's
moment.
right. It's got to actually be rotated. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which does seem, I mean, they explained how they're going to do it, but I can't say that I entirely understood. But and so they're going to roll it, and they realize that they have to close the road, not because they're worried the bridge will drop down on top of the motorists, but because everybody driving along would be looking at this amazing structure kind of crawling across the road.
Or nowadays stopping and taking photographs, actually, and
Yes,
posting them
taking
to
selfies
social
with it.
media.
And so they have to stop the traffic for these 9 nights. And they're going to do that this summer, actually, because the bridge is all ready to get to go across. And it's like an incredibly impressive structure and organization. And I think they've got 150 people working on that alone, just kind of sorting out. And then further down, there's another bridge, a somewhat longer bridge, and that bridge weighs some 4,500 tons. And it's called, it's named after a footballer,
Bellingham, the
astonishingly.
Bellingham
Yeah,
Bridge, they
the
call it.
Bellingham
Yeah.
Bridge. And
Yeah.
I wondered if it was named after Jude Bellingham, who's a very young footballer, but comes from Birmingham, first played for Birmingham City and now transferred to Real Madrid, and is like, you know, the real young up and coming thing, will be, you know, possibly the best footballer's generation. But he's already getting a bridge named after him, which is fairly extraordinary.
Yes. So as well as the viaduct, of course, we were given an overview of the station project and a chance to look out over the station construction site from the viaduct, which was very impressive. And interestingly, the plan is still to build the full 7-platform station, despite the cutbacks to the HS2 route overall. And only 4 platforms will be operational. But thankfully, for once in this country, we are doing a bit of future proofing and allowing for the possibility that HS2 might be expanded in the future.
And yes, and there's also discussion that these extra platforms, and indeed the potential extra capacity of the first 4 platforms, might be used for some sort of local services or services to the Midlands or whatever, which makes total sense. I mean, and as you say, the 3 extra platforms, there will be passive provision. So they're making the space for that and leaving that space, making it easy to turn these into platforms from the passive provision. You know, there is potential to create, you know, all sorts of services. Now, again, some of that will require a mile or two extra railway and links and so on. But it is good that they're actually making provision for that rather than just saying, oh, we're going to cut back. But, you know, Mark, it is shocking that there is no clear idea of what's happening north of Handsacre Junction.
No, indeed. And that was the great frustration of the whole thing, wasn't it? From the visit, was this feeling of this sort of this incomplete story that is not being followed through. But nevertheless, on the positive side, we were told that the piling work will begin for Curzon Street Station as early as July this year. And they're still on track, so to speak, to get the station finished by 2028. So Birmingham is going to have an absolutely sort of world-class 21st century facility there.
But with no trains, at least probably they wouldn't kind of be pinned down on opening date. But 2029 is very unlikely.
Sure.
More like 2030, 2031 was really kind of more realistic. So that station is going to sit there for quite a while unused.
That seems to be the case, doesn't it? And also, we were shown the way that the metro system will be integrated with the station and its proximity to the Digbeth Coach Station as well. So there are some efforts to integrate
But
with
no
other
direct
modes.
route on the metro between New Street and the station. I think
That's the
that's
really
a big,
curious thing, isn't it, about the whole thing?
yeah,
Yeah.
I think it's a big unanswered question there. I mean, I think they've got to get some better provision, because there's a ghastly tunnel which we both walked through, that links New Street with Moore Street, and Moore Street is quite near Curzon Street. But I really think it's unacceptable to think that many people will want to go through that tunnel and walk through with their baggage and luggage and whatever. I'm astonished that they've got no clear plans for the link. So you'd be able to take a tram to Digbeth, but then you'd have to change trams. So you'd have to take two trams to get between the two stations. I mean, that does not make any sense whatsoever.
Pretty bizarre, isn't it? Yeah, that's right.
And on our positive side, I mean, I was very taken. They showed us sort of various apprentices and people who'd been taken on to be employed there. And that was very impressive, that, it does show how spending a lot of public money, and then investing in the people who are doing it is so important. And that's
I
the
thought that
kind of
was
benefit.
inspirational, actually, I have to say,
Right,
Christian,
yeah.
that part of the discussion. And not only was it inspirational for the people that have benefited from the project, it also showed the huge sense of loss from the regions of the country that won't benefit from HS2 being
Because they've
extended
cut it
through to
back.
Manchester through as a result of the cutbacks. But
Yes, I was particularly taken with some of their stories. I mean, there was a story of, an Afghani woman who'd escaped from the Taliban, and she was now working for HS2 in some sort of coordinating capacity. And there were lots of people who had been jobless and been taken on
local
in
people,
various roles, and develop skills that would hopefully then be transferable to other jobs. So important. And so, when you say, oh, the cost of this scheme is X billion pounds, a lot of that does go towards kind of quite long-term useful aspects.
I think as well on that sort of legacy point, one of the things that came across to me that I hadn't fully appreciated before is how HS2 is being built with an expectation for all the components of a 120-year lifespan, which is much longer than typical for this kind of project. And that's one of the reasons that the components are relatively expensive because and are bespoke for this railway, because there is really nothing else like it in the country.
No, and that again, the fact that they're not continuing will mean that a lot of the skills and experience that have been picked up will be lost. And I have lots of criticisms of the whole way the project, which we can do for another podcast, about the way the project has been established and the mistakes that were made and so on. But seeing something on the ground like this happening and making a big difference and clearly having a big impact in Birmingham and on the Birmingham economy, does show that one just has to persevere. And it was great, actually. We met various very enthusiastic people, and we had a conversation with one of the very senior engineers, who just couldn't hide his enthusiasm for the whole project. And here's our interview with him.
I'm with Georgios Makakis, who is a section manager of the BBV contract, which is building a major section of HS2. And we're on the top of a viaduct, which actually will be part of the section of line that brings the trains into the station. Georgios, so tell me about, what exactly this section is, and how difficult it has been to build.
Yeah, we are actually standing, as you said, on top of the future, one of the four fingers of Curzon Approach Viaducts, where the trains will eventually come to meet the station. We are, let's say, in sublot 4, which is around 3.5 miles of an area of 3.5 miles of works, consists of different structures.
You've shown us some very complicated structures.
Yeah. I mean, we face two big challenges, obviously. Yeah. One is the logistical, being in the city centre, constructing the assets within Birmingham. And the other is, of course, the technical challenge we face. We are spanning a lot of assets, a lot of structures, a lot of different areas, businesses, network rail. Therefore, our methodology needs to be adjusted to be able to minimize any disruption. And that makes the construction of the various assets very challenging. We have several launching schemes, what we call, where we are prefabricating parts of the bridge, and we're then launching them in cantilever during blockades or night closures.
Well, one is in particular going over a major road, and it's taking you 9 nights to do. Is that right?
Yes. It's actually the one that hopefully will happen this year. It's called Lawley Middleway. It's the middle span that spans Lawley Middleway roundabout and road, which is one of the busiest ones in Birmingham. We are going to install this, as I said, hopefully this year. It's 1,600 tons of steel structure. We need to install the middle span over the road, and we're going to have 9 night closures and push the bridge over the road during this period.
And at the moment we saw this structure, and at the moment it's running parallel to the road, and of course it's got to be turned around 90 degrees and then launched.
Yes, I mean, obviously this is one of the logistical challenges. We said we're limited in terms of space, therefore we had to prefabricate it on a different orientation, and now we have to jack it up and then rotate the structure using some what we call modular vehicles to orient it with a proper to align it properly before we start the launching process, which is of course another complex part on itself.
And then you've got another bridge which is 5,500 tons. Yeah. And it's named after a footballer, I think.
They call it the Bellingham Bridge. It's actually what we call it, Curzon 2. It's an arch-shaped bridge, or Warren Truss type of structure, as we call it. It's 150 meters and is 5,500 tons. This needs to be installed over the existing network rail viaduct. So we need to, and this also this is the tallest part of the Curzon Approach Viaducts. It's the top of the arch is 42 meters. It's going to be quite dominant in the Birmingham skyline. We have to construct it over the existing network rail, as I said. So we had to prefabricate it at height around 25, 26 meters offline, and then launch it on a cantilever during a blockade over the existing network rail lines. And this will be done, hopefully, in summer 2025.
And so, basically, just tell me, how long is the viaduct leading into the platforms? And this is all up in the air, is it?
Yes. It's kind of like we come off the ground in an area called Saltley, and then it's approximately, let's say, a little more than a mile, 1.1 miles. It's a continuous viaduct. It splits in five different assets because each asset is, as I said, different in terms of complexity and type of structure. And then crosses the whole of Birmingham to reach the point where we are now, which is actually the last part, which is called Curzon 3. This is the only asset which is what we call a reinforced concrete cast in situ post tension deck structure. It's obviously done like this because of its unique shape, architecturally, of course, and because of its challenges. And this is where actually the trains, the viaduct splits into what we call the four fingers in order to
meet into four platforms.
Yes, and it's one we're standing on at the moment.
Right. And why is this all on a viaduct? Couldn't it be on the ground or in a tunnel? Did it have to be on a viaduct?
Yeah, as I said, a long time before my time, there was a lot of discussions and optioneering in order to determine the best option, cost-effective, of course, and viable, feasible. And they examined the options of tunneling, but they faced a lot of challenges. Some of them were the ground conditions, assets on the ground.
All the stuff underneath already.
Cost,
yeah.
And so on. And therefore, that was discarded. The most viable option was to go above ground. That, of course, minimized, let's say, things like land acquisition, demolition, and so on, but of course creates other challenges, which is, as I said, managing and the installation of the structures and the methodology and so on.
So, and then just turning around, we're coming into the station here. Not much has been built here, they haven't even started piling it, but essentially the platforms will be protected by a huge roof, won't they?
Yes, I mean, actually, right after us is another contractor, Mace Dragados, who will start. They've already mobilized. They're doing what we call now the enabling works, preparing for the construction phase. We are about to hand over the last spans of this viaduct to them so they can connect their future platforms with the viaduct. This, of course, is going to be done in the future years, but we are, let's say, working collaboratively with HS2 and them to be able to do this handover of this first phase and make sure everything goes smoothly. We have completed our structure, is all tested, completed, and then handed back over to HS2 to be, let's say, further developed by the rail systems and Maestro others.
Well, thank you ever so much, Georgios, and we just have a little view of the old Curzon Street station, built I think in 1836, and I can tell you that this new structure will rather dominate it to some extent, to a great extent. So thank you very much, Georgios. Thank you.
In a number of episodes of Calling All Stations, the Transport Podcast, we've looked at transport as a manifestation of the culture wars. And nowhere is that more clearly seen than in the debates, arguments, and sometimes misinformation around the allocation of road space between different users. And Christian, you've been reflecting on this and on some new developments as well.
Well, yes, there was a consultation which has now ended for May the 11th. And I have to sigh here. It was the plan for drivers, right? And this came out of the whole culture war thing about this, which was actually stimulated by the Axbridge by-election and the so-called success of the Tories in holding a fairly safe seat, thanks to, they claim, the fact that ULEZ, the ultra low emission zone, and its expansion to outer London became a key issue. Now, I have differences about that, because I think that actually the fact that the seat was nearly won by Labour anyway, and the fact that actually it was Labour's kind of retreating out of support for ULEZ, which I think made the message kind of mixed and therefore helped Labour lose the seat. But anyway, that's another debate. But nevertheless, the government, Tory government, is ploughing on with this kind of plan for drivers, which is really reversing all the terrible war on the motorist that there has apparently been for the last 50 or 60 years, and all the terrible restrictions that have been imposed more recently in low traffic neighborhoods, 20 mile an hour zones, expansion of ULEZ, and all these things, which are really, in any rational world, about the balancing between people's need to drive and convenience of car driving with the lives of people who are not in their cars. I mean, pedestrians, walkers, cyclists, whatever, public transport users. And there's this ridiculous notion, Mark, which I find the most odious aspect of this, is that there's a bunch of people called motorists and there's a bunch of people who are not motorists. And this is completely ridiculous. No, I know you're not a motorist, as it happens, but many people, and you don't own a car. I own a car, but it sits outside the house for months on end. But I am occasionally a motorist, but I'm a cyclist, a pedestrian, a public transport user. And this whole idea of kind of setting these bunches of people against each other. And in this plan for driver, the most egregious part of this is that they've gone on about these 15-minute cities, which they claim are attempts by local authorities to tax you or stop you from going beyond kind of 15 minutes of your house or whatever, when in fact the whole concept of 15-minute cities was to create areas where you could be within 15 minutes of all the things you need, schools, doctors, whatever, the shops, supermarket, and you'd have a kind of, as it were, a kind of village within towns that would then enable you to access all these things very easily. And they've turned this into this ridiculous aspect of culture wars, where they said, oh well, local authorities are trying to stop people from traveling more than 15 minutes away, or they're going to fine you. And interestingly enough, their health minister got into trouble over this recently, because she was interviewed about this and she desperately tried to cite Oxford as where they're trying to kind of do this. And of course, There is nothing in the Oxford consultation document or in any other consultation document about stopping people going beyond the 15-minute limit. And I really think this is dangerous politics, Mark. I think there's a wider issue here that this is kind of, populism at its worst, because they're putting up paper tigers and then trying to knock them down and getting people behind them.
I think one of the things I find amusing about this is the idea that the local authorities would be resourcing this kind of traffic Gestapo to stop people leaving the 15-minute range, when in fact my observation on traffic is that there's so little enforcement already of in so many respects. I mean, I'm actually fed up to the back teeth with people on electric scooters coming up behind me on the footpath and ringing the bell, inviting me to get out of the way for the electric scooter, which is illegal in itself.
And both either on pavement
and
or,
then even more illegal because it's not
goods.
On the pavement.
It's illegal.
It's
yes.
On the pavement. And similarly, the supercharged e-bikes roaring around at 40 miles an hour with no crash helmets, no proper brakes, and again no enforcement of it seems of the regulations in.
No, I mean, as a cyclist, I'm rather terrified by that, because they're built like tanks. They have little wheels. They're not bicycles, because that people don't need to cycle. They don't need to pedal.
That's right.
And they come up really fast. There is no legislation. I think there is legislation about that. I mean, that electric bikes are supposed to be limited to,
I think it's 15 miles an hour.
Miles
and also
an hour,
you're supposed to have to pedal them.
As you have to pedal to get beyond the 15 miles an hour. And yet these things... buzz along. I've been buzzed by these things at 30, 35 miles an hour. They're incredibly dangerous. And what's more ridiculous is that the government found time to legislate for pedicabs. And I can tell you, the only place that pedicabs are used is in central London, in Soho, the theatre lands and Westminster. There's a few guys eking out a living kind of riding their pedicabs, which now are kind of all decorated with bright lights and music and the like, and yet they found time to find legislation for that, but they haven't legislated about electric scooters at all, which are a growing phenomenon, which, I think if they get people out their cars, fine, but I don't think they're suitable on the pavements, and that should be enforced.
And talking of pavements, there's been a recommendation from the House of Commons Transport Committee, which I think is now about 5 years old, for legislation to ban pavement parking, which seems to be absolutely endemic as well. As people buy bigger and bigger cars, they find that they no longer fit on the roads. So their solution to this, when they're not driving them along, is to park them on the pavement. And I think that's actually illegal in London and illegal in parts of Scotland, but in most of the rest of the country, there's still a requirement for legislation to ban pavement parking. And it, in my humble opinion, it is long overdue.
Yes, I mean, they ducked out of all these things. And I just, I just weary about the fact that, there are issues here that need discussing. There might well be cases where, some of the rules around the road are unfair or whatever and need to be changed. But there isn't a general war on the motorists. And they particularly, of course, spotlighted on Wales. And I had a long conversation with Mark Drakeford, the former First Minister in Wales. He was very interesting on this, because he said, yes, we are looking at this again, but we're only looking at it in kind of specific terms. So there might be some bits of road that were 30 miles an hour that have gone to 20 miles an hour, and it isn't really worthwhile because it's not very residential. But he also said the opposite is true, that actually he's had lots of people come to him and say, oh, my bit of road is still 30 miles an hour. We'd really like it to be 20 because there's a school along the road around the corner or whatever, and so on. And there's been cases where there was a young boy run over by a car at 20 miles an hour, and his mother has been saying, look, if that car had been going 30 miles an hour, he'd be now dead, and he's in hospital with injuries, but he's going to recover, and he'll be fine. And so there is the counter of this, and you know, the conservatives just don't seem to look at that at all. They don't seem to see the human aspects of this, where, you know, there are reasons why there are rules. There's reasons why we all drive on the left, and why there's traffic lights, and why you can't go 70 miles an hour inside towns. There's all good reasons for this, and why you can't park anywhere, you know, that you want, because it's going to block the roads. And indeed, yes, you can't park. It should be that you can't park on the pavement. So there needs to be some sensible legislation about this, and sensible kind of assessment of where we are with the new technology and so on. And let's hope, again, this is that ever-lengthening agenda that the Labour Party faces when it gets into government.
Here's Christian's final thought from the Departure Lounge.
Well, coming on from our little discussion about the so-called war on motorists, it is extraordinary that the government has found some time to issue a consultation paper on the use of classic cars. And now it says extraordinarily in this consultation paper that this is an industry that is worth £18 billion a year and employs quite specifically 113,000 people. Now, I saw a classic car the other day in London, a Bentley, but I don't see many classic cars. But it seems to kind of be implying that any car that still has spark plugs or a carburetor or something is a classic car, and that any mechanics with the skills to repair that is part of this huge £18 billion a year industry. But I see no real evidence that there is such an industry. And again, it's a reflection on the fact that they can find time to put out a consultation paper, which incidentally has no suggestions at all about what to do. It's just asking for views. They've got time to put out such a consultation paper and yet not legislate on matters that are much more pressing, such as we said, e-scooters, or really sorting out the kind of legal situation for you know, various types of new devices that are appearing on the streets.
Calling All Stations, the transport podcast with Christian Walmart, is produced by Cogitamus Limited, a leading provider of public affairs consultancy services in the sector. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have, please consider giving us a 5-star rating with whichever platform you use. Do also follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle is @AllStationsPod.